Transport Minister has also been speaking about the crash at a press conference this morning, and he denied claims that the airline was trying to save money by taking a shorter route over that conflict zone in Ukraine. And he said other airlines used the same route as well.
The flight path taken by MH17 was approved by the International Civil Aviation Organizations and by the countries whose airspace the route passed through, and the International Air Transportation Association, IATA, has also stated that their airspace the aircraft was traversing was unrestricted. 15 out of 16 airlines in the associations of the Asia Pacific Airlines fly this route over Ukraine. European airlines also use the same route and travel the same airspace. In the hours before the incident, a number of other passenger aircraft from different carriers used the same route. There were no last-minute instructions given to the pilots of MH17 to change the route of the flight.
And that was the Malaysian Transport Minister Liao Chung Lai talking earlier today. We're joined now by Dr. Peter Hollingsworth. He's a civil aviation engineer and a lecturer at the University of Manchester. And thanks indeed for joining us, Peter. Let's take up that point first. I see the European Flight Safety Body Eurocontrol says that Ukrainian authorities today have now closed that airspace in the east of the country. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. They closed it in response, obviously, to the events yesterday.
But from what all the pilots are saying and what the airlines are saying, this is a route that's one of the most common routes for flights across Europe.
Yeah, it would be very common for routes from Europe, from Western Europe to the Far East, to, say, Malaysia or even China and Hong Kong. A couple airlines had been avoiding it, but as a rule, it was considered safe until yesterday.
And is there a protocol or is there a general guideline about flying above conflict zones?
I don't think there's probably a general guideline. What they'll do is they'll issue specific warnings. In this case, I think flights below 30,000 feet were advised against because that gave a safe buffer against the man portable systems that they knew were being used. But this was a completely different system that was far more capable.
Let's try and paint a picture of what happened here, because you're an expert, as I said, in this whole area. For a ground-to-air missile to take down an aircraft, how does that work? How do these missiles work, and what would, if anything, the people or the pilots on board the plane know about what was happening on the ground?
Yeah, these missiles are quite large. They're about 5 to 6 meters long and almost 30 centimeters in diameter, and they weigh, you know, 3/4 of a ton. So they're what they do is they use a ground-based radar to search and identify the targets. And then depending on the type of missile, there'll be a radar on the ground that paints the target, and the missile will follow the return from that radar, or the more sophisticated missiles actually have their own radar for the final sequence. And then as they get near the aircraft, they have what's called a proximity fuse, and they have a warhead that's, in this case, about 70 kilograms, so it's quite large, that is designed to detonate. These missiles were developed during the Cold War to shoot down American and Western bombers, so, you know, they're fully capable, and unfortunately, they're very good at shooting down an aircraft like the Malaysian airliner yesterday.
And in terms of the radar on the ground, is there any help there in identifying the kind of aircraft that it's targeting?
Not really. You can tell sometimes by the flight path and the like. This one was flying pretty straight and level at 33,000 feet, but there's often a lot of confusion, and there have been cases in the past where airliners have been shot down mistakenly just because of that. And it may be that the crew that was operating this was inexperienced, and that only added to the factors involved.
Let's move on to the investigation that's about to take place now. And what I'm interested in is who's actually going to be in charge of this investigation. We've got teams apparently from several different countries coming to the site. It's in an area we know that's controlled by separatists. Who will take charge? How will that work?
Well, under ICAO rules, this would still be considered Ukrainian airspace, so they would be in charge. As you said, it's disputed, so that puts a lot of that up in the air. You know, the Russians will probably be involved on some level, but they have a lot of expertise. At the same time, the Americans and the UK Air Accident Investigation Branch will probably be involved. But there's a lot of politics to settle out over who, you know, who has access to the site, where the remains of the aircraft go, and you know, there's a chance that some of the critical components could be taken away by locals. Hopefully that won't happen.
Yeah, obviously difficult to preserve the scene and yeah. to, you know, with claim and counterclaim going back and forth, can we be sure that things aren't removed or planted?
It's probably impossible to ensure that things aren't removed or planted. However, there's enough total wreckage that, you know, they should be able to get a good picture of what happened. Unfortunately, due to the political situation, there's also the likelihood that if one side or one group doesn't like the outcome, they will use, you know, the fact that this site was disputed to counter whatever claim or whatever findings from the investigation, and that there's always that risk.
We've heard that the black box has been recovered. What kind of information will that contain that will be useful in telling us anything about who might have been behind it or what exactly happened?
Yeah, it won't tell you anything about who was behind it. That we'll find out probably kind of secondhand from secret sources that say the Americans have, or the British or other people have. But what it will tell is the sequence of events. So the black box records the parameters of the aircraft. It also records the conversation on the flight deck. Depending on where the explosion occurred, where the detonation occurred, you might get response from the flight crew. You also might have sensors failing before the whole before the black boxes go offline. But the other thing is, in the wreckage, there will be really clear indication of the damage caused by the warhead and the like. That those are they're pretty obvious types of damage that come out of that.
Okay, Dr. Peter Hollingsworth, thank you very much for joining us this lunchtime.